Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in studio right now is Dr. Nancy Langston from Michigan Tech. She's a professor at the Department of Social Sciences and Forestry, and also Elizabeth Dell, who is the Great Lakes Regional Coordinator for the Citizens Climate Lobby. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to be here again.
Great. Elizabeth, let me start with you, just if you can give me an idea what the Climate Change Lobby is.
Okay. So Citizens Climate Lobby is a nonpartisan grassroots advocacy organization. We were founded 10 years ago and have grown considerably. And from starting with one chapter in San Diego, and now we have almost 400 chapters around the world. We have about 350 chapters in the United States, and this will be our 14th chapter that we're starting in Houghton for Michigan.
Who makes up the Citizens Climate Lobby? Who makes that up?
People like me. I live in Traverse City, actually, and I started volunteering with Citizens Climate Lobby 4 years ago when a chapter started there. So these chapters are all run by volunteers, and we have a pretty small staff altogether. Our national office is in California, and then we have staff who live across the country and work out of their homes. But our mission is our purpose is to create a livable planet. And we do that by empowering individuals to have breakthroughs in their individual and personal political power. That's one of the most important components of what we do, is empowering people like me, who wasn't involved in advocating for specific legislation, at least at this level, beyond, you know, the occasional phone call to Congress saying whether I agree or don't agree on a particular legislation that was being, you know, that's being considered. Now I'm advocating for a specific policy, and that's what all of our volunteers are doing, advocating for specific climate legislation.
Now, as a resident of Northern Michigan, do you focus pretty much on the Great Lakes area? And you're not from the Upper Peninsula, but you're right there on Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes, so.
Yeah, well, in my role as a regional coordinator, I support our chapter leaders in the Great Lakes region. So that also includes in Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and Wisconsin.
And who do you lobby then?
We lobby our members of Congress, so those are our U.S. senators and representatives, because we are looking at federal legislation.
Okay. And so what brings you to the Upper Peninsula today, then?
Well, we're starting a chapter here in Houghton. Tomorrow there's going to be, well, Saturday there's going to be a training for new volunteers to explain how we work and to explain about our carbon fee and dividend proposal.
And Dr. Langston, if you can talk about Michigan Tech's involvement with this, and then kind of like why you're here today as well.
Sure. There are lots of researchers at Michigan Tech who are working on climate change. I'm one of them. I work on climate change effects on the Lake Superior Basin. But I'm here today not so much as a representative of Michigan Tech, because we're typically scientists doing scientific research, but as someone who passionately cares about Lake Superior and our watershed. I had been pretty depressed about the potential for climate change to get really bogged down in partisan politics. I think the scientists are really clear, it's real, it's happening, and we can do something about it. But it felt like the political dynamics had gotten stuck, with nothing was happening. And CCL inspired me, because I saw that there were ways that people could reach out across the partisan divides and find a market-based solution to reduce carbon in a way that would also stimulate our economy. And I thought that was good for the Upper Peninsula and good for our community and also good for Lake Superior.
So my next question then probably is best addressed to Elizabeth then. Nancy brought up market-based solutions. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about lobbying for legislation, what kind of legislation are you looking for?
Well, we are advocating for a proposal called carbon fee and dividend. And as Nancy said, it's a market-based solution, because what we have is a market failure. Burning fossil fuels has a lot of hidden costs in it, in addition to the climate change that we're seeing with more extreme weather, There's a lot of health impacts from burning fossil fuels. It's very expensive for our military to protect energy supply lines. So these are all costs that we are all bearing, and it's going to become more and more expensive. And so economists say if you want to reduce the use of something or demand for something, you need to make it more expensive. So what we're proposing is a carbon fee, a steadily rising carbon fee. It would start out low at $15 per ton of CO2 emissions. So a fossil fuel producer would pay that. It would be assessed at the point of extraction, meaning, you know, at the mine, the oil well, the wellhead, the port of entry. It would then rise every year by another $10 per ton of CO2 emissions. And that would go into a fund that would then be returned to American households on a per capita basis. So I would get the same amount in a monthly dividend check as Nancy would, as you would. And this helps protect lower and middle income families in particular from rising energy costs as we're transitioning to cleaner sources of energy.
As soon as you start talking about whether it's a carbon tax, footprints, cap and trade, any type of those suggestions that have been made to address this problem from a market perspective, you're going to lose people. And I understand that that's probably a battle you've been having even right now.
Well, sure. It's complicated to explain policy like this. But economists across the political spectrum really believe that putting a price on carbon is the most efficient and most effective way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And, for example, former Secretary of State George Shultz, he's also a former Treasury Secretary. He's an economist, and he is an advocate for a proposal very much like this. He's on our advisory board, and he says that this is the most transparent way as well of dealing with this. And again, because you have that dividend for families, it really will help. It will protect most people as we transition. And we know that clean energy prices are already dropping significantly. So we're in the right direction already. This will just putting a price on carbon to help level the playing field with other forms of energy will just push us much faster in the direction we need to go.
If I could add to that, part of the reason that climate action has bogged down a bit in the past 10 years is that a lot of conservatives are very afraid of having the government grow, of increasing taxes and having a bigger and bigger government. And why the carbon fee and dividend proposal has gotten so much conservative as well as liberal support is that it's what economists call revenue neutral. So the government doesn't get any of the money. The government doesn't get any bigger. There are no big programs or regulatory growth. It all gets immediately returned back to consumers. And in fact, 70% of families will actually get more back as a dividend than they pay in a fee. So it has the potential to really stimulate our Upper Peninsula and Michigan economy as a whole. And so because it's a fee and dividend, conservatives as well as liberals, scientists as well as community members can come together and see that it can benefit everybody without hurting the economy.
Could you expand on that a little bit, Elizabeth? Because I'm just thinking of your average homeowner who's paying their electric bills and they're driving their cars back and forth from work. And, you know, the one thing that they're going to hear is if the fossil fuels cost more, if the production of energy costs more, then they're going to end up paying more. Mm-hmm. They're not looking at a revenue neutral system at all. They're looking at bills going up. At least that's what they're hearing. Can you address that?
Sure. So it's true that we'll pay more at the pump for gasoline and for other goods and services. But at the same time, you're receiving that dividend check back. And like Nancy said, we've had some studies done. A household impact study was done that showed that, particularly for the lowest income quintile, they received 86% of those households received more back in their dividend than they would be paying in additional costs related to rising energy prices. So most families, and again, we're focusing particularly on the families that are going to be most impacted, will come out ahead or break even.
So one way to think about that with this proposal, initially it would be 8 cents a gallon more at the pump with current gas prices. But every single family would receive exactly the same check 4 times a year or monthly. I'm getting the different proposals slightly mixed up.
Well, we're proposing monthly.
Monthly, yeah. And so the Schultz and Baker and Paulson, the other conservative group that's has a very, very similar proposal are proposing quarterly. But the key point is you are paying 8 cents a gallon more at the pump if the gas companies pass all the extra costs to the consumers, which you might predict would happen. But most families, 70% of families, in their monthly dividend check would get back much more than they've paid in increased gas prices and increased home heating bill prices.
So when you're referring to a dividend check, you're talking about a check for cash, not a tax credit or any other type of incentive. They would get a check in the mail.
Or more likely a direct deposit. But yes, money right into your bank account. Okay. Yes.
How would that money be distributed?
Well, the U.S. Treasury would collect the money, and then the Treasury would then work with other systems that we have. I mean, we have Social Security Administration. There are a lot of ways that we're already doing this, you know, with our federal tax returns, for example. So there are systems in place that we can take advantage of to keep the costs very minimum for running the program.
I guess I should clarify, to whom will the money be distributed to then?
To you, to me.
Right.
So for example, I'm married and I have one child. So my husband and I would each get, we would get a deposit where the share for me would be the same as the share for him. And then our son would actually get a half share. So you get up to 2 children in a household get a half share.
Okay, so not based on income or any other factors
then. No, it's not based on anything like that. And, for example, we had a study done by Regional Economic Models, Inc., which is a very reputable economic modeling firm. They've done research and modeling for the American Gas Association, the Nuclear Energy Institute, labor unions, different units of government. So they're a nonpartisan firm. And they did a study that showed that after 10 years, the monthly dividend check for a family of four would be $288. And they also showed that GDP would grow, that gross domestic product, that jobs, there would be an increase in the number of jobs. This is because of this economic stimulus, essentially. By getting some of this money back, people are able to spend it on other things like healthcare and retail and, you know, construction, you know, building houses and, you know, things like that. Importantly, two other things that are very important to note is that it showed that 13,000 lives a year would be saved because of decreased pollution. And we would see a drop of carbon emissions, CO2, greenhouse gas emissions, of 33% after 10 years and 52% after 20 years. So that's very significant.
And one thing, as scientists, we say a lot, 97% of scientists have consensus that climate change is real and at least significantly caused by humans. But what we often don't hear is that 99% of economists have reached consensus that a market-based solution to climate change won't hurt the economy, that it's possible, it's doable, and we should move forward with it. So there's even more consensus among economists on a solution. But what's so interesting to me is we hear a lot of numbers, and I'm a scientist, so I'm constantly talking numbers, but it's easy to forget that we live in, I think, the most special place in the world. This is the biggest lake in the world. It's, you know, an extraordinary place. Our forests have recovered. We were devastated by poor decisions over a century ago. The logging that was so fast really stripped our forests bare. And a lot of people thought Lake Superior could never recover. And it did. You know, we have trees again. We have forests. We have the cleanest water in the world, practically. But we also have the lake that's the most rapidly warming large lake in the world. It's really extraordinary. And we're at a moment right now where we can choose to make a difference, where this lake that is such a precious resource, you know, headwaters of 21% of the world's fresh water, there I am, science numbers, but also a place that we all love. You know, we know this is a special place. We know this is the most amazing lake in the world. But a lot of people don't realize it's warming so fast. The lake lake temperatures are warming twice as fast as our air temperatures. But we can do something about it. It's not hopeless. We're at a moment where we can really make a choice that won't hurt the economy and will protect the most important resource in the world, which is, I think, Lake Superior, the world's fresh water.
Elizabeth, I'm sure that people have brought up that it appears that investments by our government into alternative energies have not done well. Alternative fuels have not taken off the way that if they appeared to going to be successful in an open and free market, that they should just be booming if they were the move of the future. I'm sure you've heard this argument. Mm-hmm. So will the money that is being generated through the fees and dividends, will that go towards subsidizing or supporting alternative energies?
No. We propose that 100% of the net revenues after administrative costs are returned to households as a dividend. The reason that this is important is it sends a market signal, and the market will take care of this on its own. It's going to let investors know and consumers know that fossil fuels are becoming more expensive. We need to make different investment choices. So there will be even more innovation in clean energy technologies. It will just drive things in that direction. And again, it's addressing those external costs of burning fossil fuels that none of us are paying for. And there are a lot of folks who are really concerned about that we might not all be aware of. The insurance industry is deeply concerned about this and have many reports about climate change and the impacts it's going to have on their industry. The military has, the Pentagon has been calling climate change a threat multiplier for many years, meaning that it can create a situation that's already difficult, perhaps, for example, in Syria, where you have a dictator, you've got people moving into the city from drought. The drought was exacerbated by climate change. It's one of a number of factors that can contribute to a worsening problem. The military is very concerned about this, and they're concerned about having to, be moving, transporting fuel in very dangerous areas. Their soldiers are being killed in these transport situations. And if they can be moving to renewable energy sources, if we can all be doing that, then it protects our soldiers as well. So there's so many different reasons to want to be moving to cleaner energy.
I keep trying to think of questions that, an average person will have, as they're listening to this radio program. And those are the ones I try to throw out so mm-hmm. that we can address the people who are listening. Mm-hmm. And so if this was successful, if the program was implemented and successful, then over time, as the cost of fossil fuels go up, then people will produce less, purchase less, and then so the dividend checks would go down, and that's what you would want, basically. It would go down eventually because the use of fossil fuels would have gone down, then being replaced by alternative forms of energy.
Right. That's correct.
See, I am listening, and I am getting this. How's the rallying effort going for mm-hmm. support for this?
Well, it's going well. We're feeling encouraged. It's... there's a lot of steps along the way, but we've made a lot of progress. For as I've mentioned, our organization has grown tremendously, and I think that's for some of the reasons that Nancy described. I mean, we're an organization that is all about being for something rather than against something, and we work very hard to build good relationships with our members of Congress. We don't go in there to yell at them and tell them why they're wrong about something. We go in there to meet with them and find common ground and try and understand what their concerns are about working on this issue, what kinds of solutions can we come to together. And one of the things that gives me a lot of hope is that a little over a year ago, a House Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus was formed with a representative from Florida, well, two representatives from Florida, a Democrat and a Republican, who came together to form this caucus. And a lot of this is because of the work that we do to build political will in congressional districts for solutions. So they came together, formed the caucus, and there are now 38 members of the caucus. It's 19 Democrats and 19 Republicans. You have to join in a pair. That got off balance after the election, but because of some people losing seats or retiring. But now it's up to 38 members, like I said, and 13 Republicans have joined just since the election. So there's, I mean, that's really quick to have that many people joining this caucus. And in fact, just yesterday, a couple of the members announced that they are introducing a bill called the Climate Solutions Commission Act. And it would establish a commission with 10 members, 5 appointed by Republicans and 5 appointed by Democrats, to undertake a comprehensive review of economically viable public and private actions or policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So, I mean, in this time of very divisive politics, this kind of work is so rewarding. Trying to talk with people who might have different points of view from you and really trying to understand how together we can move forward on solutions.
One of the people we've been working with, Elizabeth mentioned that we work with our congressional representatives. So we have been working with Representative Bergman's staff. And Bergman, of course, is a Republican, but he has committed to working on climate change. But it's really important to him that it be a bipartisan approach and that it not hurt the Upper Peninsula economy or the economy of all of northern Michigan. So what I say to his staffers when I meet with them is the same thing I say to my students, which is that, you know, we're a diverse country politically. It's absolutely fine to have a conservative position on climate change, just as it's great to have a liberal position on climate change. But it's not the science itself that should be politicized. We're beyond that now, just like we're beyond the politicizing gravity. Gravity doesn't care who you voted for if you step out of a 60-story window, right? But where we do have a lively political debate that is great is what role should the government have? Should we be regulations as an approach? Should we be market-based approach to, say, taking care of gravity? Should it be the federal government that decides the thickness of the window or the local government? Should it be taxes or incentives? And I think we're at the same place with climate change. Let's just stop arguing about the science. Let's instead have a respectful, lively debate over how we should approach the solutions. Should it be regulatory like the Clean Power Plan? Should it be a market-based approach like a fee and dividend? Should it be some mixture of both of them? And that's where it's great to have your political opinions and engage in a respectful but lively political debate.
I think we're, you know, some hurdles that you'll have to jump over, and I'm sure you encounter them all the time, is people are going to say that, you know, a proposal like this would have all the opposite effects of the ones that you had mentioned, that it would be a job killer, that it would, you know, really damage the economy because they'll say the prices of things will go up. They won't trust that the money will go through streamlined to, you know, to individuals, that they won't, you know, won't be revenue neutral. The government will have to take a share out of that just to pay for the bureaucracy to be able to put this in place and maintain it. So I'm sure you heard all of these. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, we have to do something, for one thing. And there's no solution is going to be without its negative impacts. But the problem is so great that the impact of not dealing with it is going to be far, far greater than the impacts that we experience now in some areas of the economy as a result of addressing it. You know, nobody wants to see people lose their jobs. Of course not. But we have to think of the greater good and start making hard decisions about how we can prevent greenhouse gas emissions from just spiraling out of control and continuing to see the kinds of extreme weather events that we're experiencing, the warming of Lake Superior, like Nancy said. We have to act.
Elizabeth, if somebody wants to find out more about the Citizens Climate Lobby or learn more about the Revenue Neutral Carbon Fee and Dividends Program, how do they do that?
Well, they can look at our website, citizensclimatelobby.org. There's, like I said, there's going to be a Houghton chapter here starting, and they can go onto the website and look for Take Action, and they'll see chapters, and they can find the Houghton chapter and contact the Houghton chapter that way. And I'd just like to say also that on June 13th, we'll be in Washington, D.C. for our seventh annual lobby day. And we're expecting 950 people will be lobbying, and many more will be there for our conference, which is taking place a couple days before. Last year, Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers had almost 1,400 meetings with congressional offices. So we're serious about this. We meet with our members of Congress often, and we're really excited about our next lobby day.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.